Well, good morning, everyone. Oh, for the old common law days when the first question to a jury was there negligence, which was a cause, and everyone was worried about negligence, and the question of a cause never really came into it. I've just finished two fairly simple common law trials by jury, in which causation was everything, never more so than neither was a medical negligence case. One was an industrial accident, one was a transport accident, but causation ruled the roost. And so more and more, as litigation becomes more complex and more cutting edge, issues of can you establish causation and how do you quantify it come to the fore. And so the topics this morning I think are very informative, and I've looked at the material and it's very interesting. So hence no doubt the big turnout. The first speaker, Jessica Clark, is a newcomer to the bar. She worked as a solicitor in a boutique commercial firm before joining the bar. She's a registered nurse and is developing a common law practice. And she's about to speak to you on the interesting topic of how do you determine and prove life expectancy.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you all for coming so early this morning. This morning I'll be talking about estimating life expectancy of plaintiffs after catastrophic injury in light of Justice Kaye's decision in VWA and ASICSA. Determining what is the best method of assessing life expectancy has been a long-standing issue in personal injury cases. Plaintiffs have tended to rely on anecdotal evidence of treating doctors, whereas defendants have taken more of an epidemiological approach to assessing life expectancy. In his judgment in ASICSA, Justice Kaye dealt with the question of how to best approach dealing with life expectancy after catastrophic injury. The assessment of life expectancy is critical in medical negligence cases and personal injury cases as a whole, because that estimate of life expectancy will directly reflect quantum. While ASICSA was a work cover case, Justice Kaye's decision in relation to the assessment of life expectancy is also relevant to medical negligence, and in particular to cerebral palsy cases and cases where the plaintiff is an infant. On the 14th of July 2006, a 21-year-old Wally Hidalgo, or Wally as he's referred to throughout the judgment, suffered a catastrophic injury as a result of a workplace accident. At the time of the accident, Wally was a university student working part-time. On the day of the accident, he was working at the premises of ASICSA, who was the first defendant. And at the time of the accident, a wooden crate containing a large sheet of glass was delivered to the premises of ASICSA by Simon Transport Proprietary Limited, the second defendant. The sheet of glass was manufactured and packaged by CSR Viridian Proprietary Limited, the third defendant. Once the glass was delivered, Wally was required to move the glass in the crate onto ASICSA's premises with the use of a forklift. During the move, Wally stopped the forklift walked around the front of the crate. While he was doing this, the crate slipped off the forklift and crushed him. There was a 10-minute period between the accident and Wally being detected. During that time, he was under the crate, unable to breathe, and as a result, suffered a hypoxic brain injury. Wally's injuries rendered him totally and permanently dependent on full-time care. Following the accident, pursuant to its obligations under the Accident Compensation Act, the VWA made substantial payments to and on behalf of Wally. The VWA then claimed indemnity pursuant to Section 138 of the Act from the three defendants for money paid by it to and on behalf of Wally. The court was required to consider five main issues at trial. That is the probable life expectancy, the amount of damages to which Wally would have been entitled to at common law for the gratuitous care provided to him by his parents, the amount of general damages which would have been awarded to Wally at common law, in particular, whether he had any insight or awareness into his circumstances, the appropriate discount for vicissitudes for the purposes of estimating future loss of earnings during the lost years, and whether, in performing a notional assessment of damages, of hypothetical damages, an allowance should be made for fund management expenses. The case is well worth reading in its entirety, as the five main issues considered at trial are all quite interesting and important to medical negligence trials. But the focus of this presentation will be on how the court calculated life expectancy. Following the injury, Wally was in a permanently and totally dependent, in a state where he was permanently and totally dependent on full-time care. He, immediately following the injury and for the years leading up to trial, he was in a persistent vegetative state. However, in the 2 years in the lead up to trial, some small improvements in his state of alertness were observed, which made it seem as though he'd progressed from a vegetative state to a minimally conscious state. He was immobile and essentially unable to interact with his environment. He had a tracheostomy, which had been in place since 13 days after the accident. For feeding, he required a PEG tube, which had been in place since approximately 1 month after the accident. And he was doubly incontinent, requiring condom drainage to manage his urinary incontinence and nappies and pads to manage his bowel actions. In total, in this case, there were 7 experts called on the question of life expectancy, and they all had significantly differing views as to life expectancy. Those views, the estimates range from 12 years to 37 years from the time of trial. And Justice Kaye found at paragraph 133 that assessing life expectancy in this case was significantly different to cases which involved the question of life expectancy of a plaintiff who had a terminal disease or disorder. Found that in such cases, medical opinion is generally able to provide a reasonably precise answer because the terminal illness or condition itself will cause death. In this case, the disabilities suffered by Wally Hidalgo will not directly cause his death. Rather, what may be fatal to him are the potential consequences of those disabilities. In other words, his disabilities have rendered him vulnerable to a number of risks to his health and survival. And in terms of those risks, it was agreed by all of the experts called at trial that the risks that Wally was likely to suffer were aspiration pneumonia, urinary tract infections, infection from pressure sores, infection of his PEG site, a lowered mineral bone density, and a pulmonary embolism resulting from deep vein thrombosis. Detailed evidence was given and relied on at trial as to the level of care that was provided to Wally. This was adduced by the plaintiff for two purposes. Firstly, as it was relevant to life expectancy, and secondly, it was relevant to the matter of the gratuitous care that was provided to him by his parents. The evidence given was that Wally received 33 hours of care per 24-hour period from carers, plus additional care from his parents. He was cared for by a team of 12 carers. In that team, there were 2 qualified medical practitioners, 8 qualified nurses or student nurses, and 2 carers with certificates in disability. The care provided to Wally daily included hygiene care, general cleaning, exercises, regular checks for pressure sores, regular moving and repositioning to reduce the risk of pressure sores. He had his vital signs checked and recorded 4 times a day. He had a fluid balance chart maintained. He had his tracheostomy and PEG sites cleaned regularly, and he received whole body massages daily due to his immobility. And when a new carer started working, they'd be trained by the physiotherapist and the occupational therapist who were responsible for Wally's overall care. In addition, they'd spend 20 hours shadowing an experienced carer before they were allowed to work on their own. It was also accepted that Wally's parents played a vital role in supervising the care provided to Wally. In relation to the level of care, Justice Kaye ultimately found at paragraph 24 that the level of care was first class and indeed quite exceptional. Now, as a result of this high level of care that had been provided to Wally, at the time of trial, he'd had no urinary tract infections since discharge from the rehabilitation facility approximately 14 months after the injury. He'd had only two chest infections since discharge from the rehabilitation facility. And of importance, both of these chest infections were quickly identified and dealt with well by antibiotic therapy. He'd had no pressure sores or lesions and no bouts of ill health since 2009. Now, the plaintiff called three experts on the question of life expectancy. Firstly, they called Professor Rewicki, who is a specialist in rehabilitation medicine. He estimated Wally's life expectancy to be 37 years from the time of trial. In coming to that conclusion, Professor Rewicki looked at normal life expectancy of a 25-year-old man and reduced it by 30% due to the risk of complications Wally was likely to suffer from his injuries. Professor Rewicki was of the view that due to the high level of care provided to Wally, complications would be detected early and treated appropriately, and therefore their consequences, particularly consequences in relation to infection, would be adequately prevented. The plaintiff also relied on Dr. Tierney, a GP who specialises in treatment of patients with acquired brain injuries. She estimated Wally's life expectancy to be 16 to 21 years from the time of trial. She reviewed Wally at home and concluded that the standard of the care provided to Wally was quite extraordinary and well above that which he would receive in a hospital nursing home. She also noted that the level of proactive management of health issues had a significantly beneficial effect on his life expectancy. The method Dr. Tierney used to assess life expectancy was that she'd looked at other patients she treated over her 25 years experience and used that to form a view of Wally's life expectancy. The plaintiff's third expert was Professor Jane Hutton, a professor in medical statistics. She estimated Wally's life expectancy to be 22 to 31 years from the time of trial. And in coming to this assessment, she used a cerebral palsy register study and a method referred to as the disability rating scale. The defendant called four experts on the question of life expectancy. And there was Professor Stark, a neurologist, who estimated Wally's life expectancy to be 15 years from the time of trial. He found that even with the best nursing and general care, Wally's life expectancy was reduced due to a number of complications. In coming to his assessment of 15 years, Professor Stark referred to statistics produced by Dr. Chevelle, who was the defendant's statistical expert, and then factored in quality of care. Professor Stark also noted that there was a risk that practitioners like Dr. Tierney, who treat patients like Wally on a regular basis, may be over-influenced by their experience and ignore statistical evidence. The defendant's second expert was Professor Davis, a neurologist. He also estimated Wally's life expectancy to be 15 years. He assessed Wally twice at home. He noted that while Wally receives excellent care, he's still susceptible to a number of complications. He also referred to the statistics of Dr. Chevelle and concluded, based on those statistics, that Wally fell into a category of patients whose life expectancy would be approximately 12.2 years from the current date. But then he did ultimately concede that Wally might live for 15 years. He also noted that anecdotal experience of treating doctors is important, but that it's not as important as statistics. The defendant relied on a third neurologist, Dr. John King. He estimated Wally's life expectancy to be 12 years from the time of trial. In his evidence, he noticed that statistics are important in predicting life expectancy, and he didn't consider that the anecdotal evidence of Dr. Tierney was helpful, as in his view, such practitioners give undue weight to patients who have survived the longest, and they tend mainly to care for patients who are long-term survivors. Under cross-examination, Dr. King agreed that it was appropriate to take statistical figures and adjust them to the level of care. However, he, in re-examination, he stated that when coming to his conclusion of 12 years, he did factor in the level of care. Finally, the defendant relied on Dr. Chevelle, an expert statistician specialising in life expectancy. Dr. Chevelle estimated Wally's life expectancy to be 12 years from the time of trial. He criticised both methods used by Professor Hutton. In his approach, he used 5 studies of life expectancy of severely disabled persons and made adjustment to that life expectancy in each case to allow for the differences that existed between Wally and the cohort. Now, the defendant criticised the plaintiff's statistical evidence for 2 principal reasons. Firstly, that the cohort relied on was not sufficiently comparable to Wally, and secondly, that Professor Hutton erred in using a constant excess death rate when creating her life table. And an excess death rate is the deaths that occur in a particular group minus the deaths that occur in the normal population of people at that age. Justice Kay found that Professor Hutton's cohort was not sufficiently comparable to Wally, and the reason for that was most people in the cohort didn't require a feeding tube, whereas Wally did, and that's suggestive of a greater level of vulvar dysfunction, which means that they're more likely to be at risk of aspiration. Justice Kay also accepted the defendant's submission that it would have been more appropriate for Professor Hutton to use a proportional excess death rate, which takes into account that the death rate increases with age, as opposed to the constant excess death rate. The plaintiff also criticised the defendant's statistical evidence for 2 principal reasons. Firstly, that Dr. Chevelle failed to take into account the time that had passed since the injury, which it submitted was a positive predictor for survival. And secondly, that Dr. Chevelle made unnecessary downward adjustments to the estimation of life expectancy for the studies that he relied on. Justice Kay didn't accept the plaintiff's first criticism. His Honour then went on to examine each of the studies Dr. Chevelle relied on to adjust the life expectancy downwards, and he ultimately concluded that Dr. Chevelle's downward adjustment was too low. Based on his findings about the expert evidence of both statisticians, Justice Kay adjusted the initial assessments of both Professor Hutton and Dr. Chevelle, and he ultimately found at paragraph 135 that the corrected views of Dr. Chevelle would produce a life expectancy of 14 years, while the corrected computations of Professor Hutton would produce an estimated life expectancy of 18 to 19 years. In terms of the preferred approach to assessing life expectancy, Justice Kay ultimately found at paragraph 143 that the basic approach to the issue of life expectancy by Professor Davis, Professor Stark and Professor King, and they were the 3 neurologists called by the defendant, is a correct and appropriate means of estimating Wally's life expectancy. Justice Kay did not accept that the anecdotal evidence of Professor Rewicki and Dr. Tierney had primary weight in determining the issue of life expectancy, and found at paragraph 143 that the more sound and appropriate method of deciding the question is to base an estimate on statistical evidence and to adjust it by giving appropriate weight to both the exceptional quality of care given to Wally and also the anecdotal experience of Professor Rewicki and Dr. Tierney. Interestingly, he also found that there was no basis to prefer one adjusted view of either statistical expert as invalid or to prefer one view over the other. His Honour also noted that the view of Dr. Tierney and Professor Rewicki may be overly influenced because they generally treat survivors. However, he did find value in their evidence due to their long experience, from which they can conclude that a high level of care is capable of making a significant difference to the estimation of life expectancy. Ultimately, Justice Kay estimated Wally's life expectancy to be 20 years from the time of trial. In terms of how all of this applies to practice, it's important to note that statistical evidence really needs to be taken into account in conjunction with medical evidence of the treating doctor. The starting point is to obtain opinion from a statistician. It's really important to ensure that the pool of participants or the cohort in the study is sufficiently comparable to the plaintiff. From there, both plaintiffs and defendants should obtain medical reports which address the statistics. And it's also really important to consider any special or additional factors that are likely to impact on life expectancy, such as in this case, the particularly high level of care that was given to Wally, and anecdotal evidence of treating doctors. Thank you.
It was a recovery action, that case, everyone. And if everyone has any understanding of recovery actions, what happens is under the accident Compensation Act, when the VWA is seeking recovery, the basically old common law approach to assessment of damages applies. Multipliers change. There are no thresholds with respect to damages in terms of general damages. So the verdict was huge, and the I can't remember what it was. I think it was 11 million, 12 million, I can't remember. But was it? 13 million, yeah. So that tells you what plaintiffs should be recovering if the old approach without the limitations of the legislation ruled the day. So it's quite an interesting analysis.